Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Occasionally, we're able to get a hold of our next guest. He's in high demand, a best-selling author, contributor to Fox News, National Review. He's written a number of best-selling books. I just posted a picture of one of them on my Twitter account that I have in my collection, the best-selling Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Joining us now, Andy McCarthy. Andy, welcome back.
Will, how are you?
I'm good. It's great to talk with you. Hey, you know, I know that this does not bring you pleasure, but when you think about how hard you worked to gather the information to write and publish Ball of Collusion, and now you see, maybe not at the pace I'd like to see coming out, but the information from Department of Justice, particularly John Durham investigation, it seems more and more of what you wrote in that book is coming to surface, that it was all true.
Yeah,
does that
you know,
give you at
always,
least, if not pleasure, does it give you a sense of satisfaction that your work was not for vain, not in vain?
Yeah, it's gratifying. It reminds me, Will, of, you know, when you're a prosecutor on a big case and, you know, you charge a pretty ambitious theory of a big group being guilty, and then the first person comes in and pleads guilty and admits in open court that the things that you concluded based on your review of the evidence actually happened the way you said they did.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't charge the case unless you were confident, mm-hmm. just like I wouldn't publish a book under my name if I didn't think I was right. And I tried in the book to be pretty scrupulous about saying, here's what we know and here's what we don't know. But it's always a good feeling in terms of whether you went about your work responsibly when, you know, things start to bear out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's always true whenever you take a strong position about anything, you know, there's going to be some folks that are going to support you. Some folks are going to be shooting at you, you know, the slings and arrows. And I'm sure you took some criticism for the book. I know you took some criticism for the book. And now, sadly, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it seems like there was collusion going on. It wasn't between Trump and the Russians. That's for darn sure.
And, yeah. Well, we certainly know that there was collusion between the Clinton campaign and Russians. I'm not saying it was necessarily knowing collusion, although, you know, I mean, she hired a guy who was a British spy. For all the people who were worried about outside interference in the election, she hires a British spy, which before you even get to the Russian part, you have to take that sort of into account. But the whole purpose of his investigation of Trump and Russia was to tap Russian sources that they believed he had, some of which were connected to, or some of whom were connected to the government, at least they believed, to put out dirt about Trump. So that seems to me to be pretty intentional collusion with Russia, and I don't think you get to excuse it as the media and Democrats try to excuse everything by just saying that Trump is sui generis, mm-hmm. and so singularly bad in history that anything you do is, you know, it's a complete ends justifies the means situation. So I hope people are starting to see through it. The unfortunate thing about it, as far as Trump is concerned, I guess, is that I don't think this thing is changing anybody's minds anymore. I think people have kind of made up their mind what they think about it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Although there was a story that came out about a monthly poll that is held and by the Democracy Institute, and they released it on Sunday. And oddly enough, this poll shows across the board, not just in swing states, but across the board, the president having a lead over Joe Biden. And this this was done before before the COVID announcement on Friday. And so there's a lot of folks that think that there's going to be a sympathy factor that might push some other folks towards the president. And then, of course, the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett. I mean, it absolutely galvanized the president's supporters, as far as I can tell, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think where I always have come from on this, Will, is that I think sometimes, and this goes from the beginning of the administration to this day, the president overestimates his victory in 2016 in the sense that it really was statistically very improbable. You know, he went into election night behind in most of these critical battleground states, and yet he won them because he was only behind by the margin of error, and he pulled out virtually all of them, which is almost like pulling an inside straight. And we know that if, you know, if about 75,000 votes had gone the other way in five different counties in three states, the outcome would have been different. So I've always thought, you know, these guys should not play with the House money. The president needs to do a good job and draw in more support because his margin of victory was so thin the first time around. But it goes to show, I think, how, you know, mercurial and fluid the electorate is. And I don't feel confident that we know what's going to happen, you know, 4 weeks from now. I just don't.
No, I think it's way too close. I think it's way too close. I don't think anybody can sit back, particularly to your point. I don't think the last election means anything in terms of predicting this election, in the sense that other than polls were, you know, were off the last time. And and you're right. I mean, he pulled it out of the hat at the end there. But I'm surprised to, I don't know, I mentioned this in the first hour. You know, I mean, I don't like Hillary Clinton is one of the people I like least on the planet Earth, but I wouldn't wish her to get COVID and die from it. You know, there's certain people I just don't like. I won't say hate because hate's a strong word, but I have disdain for them. And Hillary Clinton, probably more than any other human being, I have total disdain for. And yet people just now seem so willing to come out and say, oh, I'm glad he got COVID. I hope he dies. What does that say about the nature of our society? And I mean, it seems like we're devolving into a very crass and raw culture, doesn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, that's, I think, Andrew Breitbart probably most famously said that culture was upstream of politics and, you know, our kind of, sewer hole politics that we have is a reflection of the coarseness of the society. I was thinking when you were saying that, you know, I've always said I was never a Trump guy. But I voted for him. And I have maintained that from the beginning that I think, you know, the two words that explain his election are Hillary and Clinton. So, you know, I figured I knew what I would have gotten from Clinton, and with Trump, I've been pleasantly surprised by a lot of it. And I've felt like, you know, the fact that you vote for whoever you vote for when it gets down to the two is not like you're endorsing either of the people. It's the choice. You have to make the choice. And, you know, Trump has been very good on the economy. He's been very good on the judges. He's been very good on things that were important to me. You have to take with the good, the Trump persona, which is part of why I wasn't crazy about him to begin with. But, you know, I find I can tune that stuff out. And it may be because, you know, my background before journalism was I dealt with like really terrible bad people all the time. So even though I feel the same way about Hillary Clinton that you do, you know, I was in a room with terrorists for 10 months once, and, you know. So but seriously, I'm amazed at how people allow Trump to get under their skin and make them crazy like they do, including people who I've always thought were reasonable, calm, good analytical people, who since Trump became president have just—they've gone loony,
kind of off the rails about it. I mean, I can separate it, I guess, but my friends who are Democrats just—they can't. And a lot of I've lost some friends over this. They just can't seem to separate Trump the past person from Trump the current policymaker. There's no way to separate them in their minds. And so, I don't think Trump's going to win any awards for outstanding husband or husband of the year. But that's not why we But that would be true of a lot of presidents. It just doesn't get the kind of coverage that Trump gets. I think one of the things, we're talking with Andy McCarthy, and it's so good to have you back on the show, Andy. One of the things I think, and I've been saying this for a long time, I think if Trump's going to have any legacy, whether he wins re-election or not, but the legacy that Donald Trump's going to have is his court appointments, 150 federal court bench appointments, and now, you know, the three Supreme Court appointments, and looks like this third one is going to get approved. Are you surprised at all that the hatred that comes out for this this nominee? When I mean, even liberals are saying that she's been a consistently amazing and good judge. Are you surprised at all the attacks that are starting to bubble up against her?
Well, no, because every time a Republican has a vacancy to fill, we get this. And I'm actually, what I do take some heart in, Will, is that the attacks on Amy Barrett have not been as sharp or as personal as the ones on Kavanaugh. Mm. I mean, they don't want her. They don't like the idea of her being on the court. They particularly don't like the idea. And I can understand this, because if I were one of the reasons I supported Trump was because the prospect to me of having a left-wing Democrat fill the seat of Antonin Scalia, who was like the foundational conservative on the court, would have been a sea change in the court. So if I were a progressive, I would feel the same way about Ruth Ginsburg's seat going to somebody who was in the Scalia mold. So I get why this is so important. I think we should all get it. But at the same time, I've been heartened by the fact that I think they realize that if on the eve of the election they tried to do to Barrett what they did to Kavanaugh, that it would blow up on them, and it would probably cost them the election if they're, you know, assuming that, as we see, that the Biden's ahead in the polls. And I think that, you know, they've also, the calmer heads, there aren't as many of them as there used to be, but they kind of realized that Barrett, aside from the fact that the Kavanaugh thing did not help them the way they conducted themselves, Barrett is also not amenable to the same kind of attack that Kavanaugh was. So I think what you're going to hear a lot is about the commentary that was made by the Republicans in 2016 about letting the voters decide. Because what else would the, the Democrats made the opposite argument 4 years ago. You won't hear that, of course. Sure. But I think they're going to keep it on process, and they're not going to go after her too hard. I mean, they'll go after her, and you also have, you know, you have the crazies out there like Crazy Maisie Hirono.
Right.
You know,
we'll go after anybody.
Kind of loose cannon. Sure. Who knows what they'll do? But I think it's mostly going to be a process argument.
I agree. I mean, how do you go after a mother of seven, two of whom are adopted children of people of color? One has special needs. She's had an exemplary record on the bench. She's already been vetted. She was already went through the process to be the current judge that she is now. How do you go after that person with a, you know, with any amount of clear conscience, right? So I think you're right. I think they're afraid to attack her personally. Up here in Connecticut, you know, we've got some crazy politics most of the time going on, but our junior senator Chris Murphy is usually the one leading the charge. He said on Friday when, and this goes back to kind of ball collusion. He said on Friday that when he found out that president had come down with COVID-19, that he would rely, the president would rely more heavily on Vladimir Putin as one of his campaign surrogates. Now, where do you got to be to say that when all of the proof of Trump collusion has been discredited? I mean, talk about things like, you know, Joe Biden said, oh, everything about Hunter has been discredited. There's nothing true about it. Okay, well, there's just a lot of money floating around. We don't know why. But there's been no question about the fact that the Trump collusion thing has completely been blown up. How do you, as a senator, continue to keep that narrative alive by making the comment that Putin would be, he'd rely on him more as a surrogate? What do you think is going on there?
Well, I think it goes to what we talked about at the beginning of our conversation about how politics is downstream from culture. And I think, unfortunately, especially as we've gotten more technically capable in terms of polling and all the things that animate people, and especially all the things that get your voters out, the unfortunate thing that's happened in America is that elections are no longer about winning the argument in fact.
Yeah.
Elections are about saying the explosive things that keep your base animated and get them to turn out as many of themselves and the people they can convince as possible. So the perverse incentive is not to say the thing that wins the argument logically, is to say the thing that fires up the base. And that's what Murphy is, you know, a classic case of it, I think.
It's so distasteful, but I mean, it is what it is. And I think you describe it completely. You know, the Democrats have been talking about, and almost in a threatening way, that, you know, Chuck Schumer certainly has talked about, you know, with the nomination of Amy Barrett as Supreme Court Justice, that everything's on the table. Everything's on the table, whatever that's supposed to mean. And they've been talking about this packing the court idea. Give our audience a little bit of understanding. When they say packing the court, specifically, what are they talking about? And is this just saber rattling, or do you think there's people that are really serious about it?
Well, there are people who are serious about it, but I don't think they're the majority. What it means is it's kind of like if you can't beat them at the game, then change the rules of the game. And it goes back to what Franklin Roosevelt, at the height of his power, in the aftermath of the 1936 election, which was a thumping historical dimension victory, where I think he won all but maybe 8 of the electoral votes in the election. Most of, you know, overwhelmingly won the states. Had a large majority in the Senate and the House. You know, super majorities. And yet, when he talked about packing the court, because Supreme Court opinions were undermining the New Deal, all these you know, fancy progressive things he wanted to do, the Supreme Court were saying, you know, they're unconstitutional. You can't do that. So his way of dealing with that was to say, let me have a bunch of slots to put a bunch of progressives on the court to change the outcome of the court decisions, which obviously politicizes the court because you're putting people on because of their ideological bent, which undermines the idea that the rule of law is making decisions, right? So even at the height of his power, Roosevelt couldn't get that done because they thought it was too radical. And no one has tried to do that ever since. Now, the Democrats have been rattling the sabers on this since Kavanaugh in particular. And it is true, Will, that there's nothing in the Constitution that says the Supreme Court has to be 9 members. It started out as 6. It went to 7. I think at one point it went up to 10 or 11. It was 9 for a while. Then it went up and back down. But since 1869, it's been 9. And since Roosevelt tried to pack the court and got slapped down, 9 has been the number that you know, people kind of accept as a wise number.
Well, to that point, Andy, I've been asking people why, you know, 9 is obviously important because of the makeup, and people are saying, well, you know, he should wait and that we shouldn't make this appointment until after the election. If you go back to 2000, though, with the Gore Bush election, it was the Supreme Court that stepped in and finally made a decision in Florida. Is it, I think, I don't know, but again, as a layman, I think it's important to not have a potentially deadlocked court at 4-4 when not knowing where Judge Roberts might be. Isn't the nine-member panel, the fully staffed nine-member panel, almost something you really want to have before you go into election because of who knows what's going to happen with mail-in ballots and the confusion that's maybe going to be brought on by that? Is it an important thing to have a fully staffed court before the election?
Well, I think it's important to have a fully staffed court because of all, if we think that nine is the right number, then if important decisions are being made, we want a fully staffed court. I've heard this point made. I'm not saying you're doing this, but I've heard other people make this point, basically suggesting that we'll have complete chaos if we don't have a nine-member court, and that's not the case. We should have a nine-member court because you want an authoritative decision made by the highest court.
Right.
But if you don't have a nine-member court, if a court splits 4-4, it's not like we have paralysis. What it means is the decision of the last court to decide gets upheld.
Right. Okay.
So it's not like no court will decide.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
most of these election decisions are state court matters.
Right.
And the Supreme Court only gets involved. The Constitution's been violated in some way, like if they change the rules of an election at the last second, which they're mm-hmm. not allowed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't worry about that so much. I think we should have nine because that's the full complement.
Mm-hmm.
And if important decisions are going to be made, we want the full complement of the court to make them. But I think Barrett should be confirmed because she's an excellent nominee.
Mm-hmm.
And if she was a mediocrity, I would think that would be more important than whether it was 8 or 9.
That's a great explanation. And you know what? That's the first time someone's explained it to me that way, and I feel better just hearing it. Listen, Andy, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to have you on. I know the folks love hearing from you, and we love seeing you on Fox News every time you come on, and it's always a joy. So thank you so much, Andy McCarthy, and keep up the good work. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.